The origins of the Israel-Palestine conflict are usually dated from the end of the 19th century, when the Zionist movement sought to resolve what was called the Jewish question in Europe at the time. And the Jewish question basically had two sides to it, and they were flip sides of the same coin. On the one side was the problem of what was called Gentile simply meaning non-Jewish, Gentile rejection or anti-Semitism, the sometimes legal, sometimes physical disabilities that were imposed on Jews in various parts of Europe. There was the problem of Gentile rejection or anti-Semitism, and then there was the reverse problem, the problem of Gentile attraction or assimilation. The fear that at least in some parts of Europe, Jews would so successfully assimilate into the countries in which they lived that they would lose their national or cultural or ethnic or religious identity. So you had two problems, the problem of Gentile rejection or anti-Semitism, and the problem of Gentile attraction or assimilation. And the Zionist movement proposed its own unique solution to this Jewish question. And the unique solution that it proposed was to create a Jewish state in Palestine. And by a Jewish state, it meant a state which was overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, Jewish. After the Zionist movement won the support of a great power for its project, in this case, Great Britain, through the issuance of what was called the Balfour Declaration, once the Zionist movement had won the support of a great power, its main challenge was the indigenous population, because Palestine at the end of the 19th century was not Jewish, but overwhelmingly Muslim and to a lesser extent Christian Arab. And the Zionist movement understood from the very beginning that there was no way that the indigenous population would acquiesce in the creation of a Jewish state, an overwhelmingly Jewish state, which at best would marginalize the indigenous population and which at worst would result in their expulsion. The Zionist movement recognized that there was no way that there can be a diplomatic, a peaceful resolution of the conflict with the indigenous population, given the goal that they had set for themselves to create an overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, Jewish state in an area which was overwhelmingly not Jewish. Given that there was no way for there to be a diplomatic or a peaceful resolution of the conflict, the fact of the matter was there were basically only two alternatives the Zionist movement can choose from. You can, in your minds, conjure up 1,000 different ways to resolve this dilemma, and presumably at these universities with all their courses on conflict resolution, they can probably churn out 1,000 different theses to resolve this conflict. But in the real world, in the practical world of politics, there were only two choices or options to choose from. And the Israeli historian Benny Morris is a very competent historian. Politically, he's a thug, but as a historian, he's competent. And Benny Morris, in an essay of his, he wrote not too long ago, he said basically the Zionist movement could choose between only one of two options. And he defined the options as follows. One, he called the Way of South Africa. And by the Way of South Africa, he meant, and it's worth quoting him for what comes later and try to bear it in mind. He says, the establishment of an apartheid state with a settler minority lording it over a large exploited native majority. So one possibility was to create an apartheid state with a settler minority lording it over a large exploited native majority. That's one possibility. And the other possibility, he said, was the way of transfer, or what we nowadays call ethnic cleansing, to simply expel the indigenous population and in that way to resolve the dilemma. Those were really the only two options the Zionist movement had available to it. And during the first period of the conquest of Palestine, roughly you could say the years 1917 to 48, roughly speaking the interwar period, the period between World War I and World War II, the Zionist movement opted during that period for the expulsion of the indigenous population, the way of transfer. There's a large amount of documentation I can bring to bear to support that claim, but for our purposes, let's move on, and for those who would like the references, I can point them out to you during the questions and answers. The Zionist movement decided on expulsion, and the question for the Zionist movement was to get the timing right. Because for someone like Ben-Gurion, the first Zionist leader within Palestine, and later the first prime minister of the state of Israel, he was a shrewd, a ruthless politician. And he recognized, he said, there are kinds of things you can get away with in what he called normal times that you can't get away with in what he called revolutionary times. And the challenge was to be prepared for when the revolutionary times come, the abnormal times come, and then, to use a current expression, you strike when the iron is hot. And he said, if you miss those opportunities, he says, a whole world is lost. Without going into a lengthy digression, it is true to say, and it's to the credit of the Zionist movement, that they were always very good, they were excellent, at exploiting very slender historical opportunities. You know, to use the old Marxist language, those slender historical opportunities, when the subjective factor becomes crucial. There are moments that come once, as Ben-Gurion said, and if you miss them, a whole world is lost. What was quite well done by the Zionist movement is when those moments came, and have come several times in the course of the history of the Zionist movement, when they did come, notably the issuance of the Balfour Declaration, the expulsion of the Arabs in 1948, the full conquest of Palestine in 1967, when the moment came, they were very prepared, and they maximized, as it were, the subjective factor. And they were very good at that, and one should acknowledge it. It was a question of excellent organization and a lot of ruthlessness. They were combined very well, and they achieved their goals. In any event, the Zionist movement opted for expulsion of the Palestinian Arab population. And right there, it clarifies a basic issue of the conflict, namely that Palestinian Arab resistance to Zionism had nothing whatever to do with an irrational hatred of Jews. It had nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It had nothing to do with any of those bogeys which are now brought into play to try to explain the Palestinian Arab opposition to Zionism. The opposition was very straightforward and very uncontroversial. They understood from the very beginnings of the Zionist movement that the success of the Zionist movement would be at their expense. So if you turn to Benny Morris, he writes at one point in his History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, he writes, "The fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. The fear of territorial displacement and dispossession was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism." Well, it seems like a fairly uncontroversial statement, and you might wonder why I even bothered to repeat it. And yet it's a very striking statement. It metaphorically leaps off the page. Because what is he saying? Or I should say, what is he not saying? He is not saying the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism is anti-Semitism. He's not saying it's hatred of Jews. He's saying their resistance was completely understandable and comprehensible. It was the fear of territorial displacement and dispossession. And in any other conflict, if this conflict were not shrouded in this thick ideological fog, it would be perfectly understood. So, for example, if you take the case of the United States, if a historian tried to explain the resistance of Native Americans to European encroachment and said that they were motivated by anti-Europeanism, or they were motivated by anti-Christianism, or they were motivated by anti-whiteism, people would just laugh because it was perfectly obvious why Native Americans were resisting European encroachment. They feared their territorial displacement and dispossession. And yet something so transparent, so obvious, becomes so obscure and so occluded when you turn to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, it is true that the Zionist movement tried to claim that the resistance to the Zionist project was motivated by anti-Semitism. As Ben-Gurion said publicly, though never privately, publicly he would say that Jews were being murdered simply because they were Jews. And that served a useful ideological function, namely its aim was to conceal from the outside world the very legitimate and rational grievances of the Palestinian resistance. It also bears notice for what I'm going to say later, that Western European public opinion during this period, the interwar period, did not categorically oppose population expulsions as a means to resolve ethnic conflicts. There's a tendency, understandable, to be skeptical about concepts like international law and international morality. But one shouldn't become so skeptical of them as to deny their, if I can use the word, efficacy in politics. They do have an effect. I'll try to illustrate this later, but for our purposes now, it's important to keep in mind that international law and international morality did, under extreme circumstances, acquiesce in, accept population transfers and expulsions. Some of you may know the most famous of this period was the population transfer expulsion exchange, whichever euphemism you want to use, between Turkey and Greece. About 1.5 million Greeks were expelled by Turkey, and then Greece expelled about 500,000 Turks. It was a very ugly affair, a very bloody affair, but public opinion, or I should say elite public opinion, came to regard the Turkish-Greek population exchange as a desirable precedent for resolving ethnic conflicts. I could cite many more examples. The one that concerns us here, it's important to keep in mind even the British Labour Party, which wasn't a radical party, but, it's not the joke it is under Tony Blair. It did have, leftist pretensions. The British Labour Party in 1944 supported the expulsion of the Arabs from Palestine and their replacement by the Zionist colonists. And even the most notable moral figure of the first half of the 20th century, he played pretty much the equivalent role in the first half of the 20th century that Noam Chomsky has in the second half, namely Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell on non-European peoples, I've just spent the last few months going through a lot of his writing, on non-European peoples, he was pretty terrible. And he supported the expulsion of the Arabs from Palestine. And generally, reading him now, even though, he's a great figure and a man of really awesome intellectual range. And he wasn't bad on the woman question. He's very similar to people like John Stuart Mill, who could be excellent on the woman question. The best part of the Western tradition, the best part of it, people represented by like Mill and Russell, are very good in the woman question, but really quite awful on the non-white, non-European question, which I think suggests, though that's a digression, that trying to extirpate racism is a much bigger challenge than trying to extirpate sexism. But that's another issue. Can't go into it now. In any case, he was terrible, and he supported the expulsion of the Arabs from Palestine. And there's also the fact that American public opinion, almost across the board from the right to the left, for those of you who know the leftist tradition, up to people like Henry Wallace, who was the left standard bearer during the 48 election, from right to left, they all supported the Zionists and they all had contempt for the Arabs, basically because they operated from this paradigm that the Zionist movement represented progress, represented civilization, represented Western values. And they operate from the point of view that, while quote a British MP, Richard Crossman, he asked the question in a book he wrote in 1944, why is it that all Americans across the board show so complete disregard for the Arab case? And his answer was, it's worth listening, he says, Zionism, after all, is merely the attempt by the European Jew to build his national life on the soil of Palestine in much the same way as the American settler developed the West. So the American will give the Jewish settler in Palestine the benefit of the doubt and regard the Arab as the aboriginal, the indigenous population, who must go down before the march of progress. And I think it's a very accurate depiction of the mindset of the time. It's an interesting quote for two reasons. Number one, for those who've studied Euro-American conquest of the West, the analogy is pretty close. I've written on the topic. I compare the fate of the Palestinians with the fate of the Cherokee Indians. And the analogy is quite close. No analogies are perfect, but the similarities are resonant enough that the analogy is quite good. So number one, the analogy is right. If you want to understand what happened and what continues to happen to the Palestinians, look at the history of the conquest of the American West. The second reason the quote is quite interesting is the analogy is correct, but the moral value we attach to it is very different today. We no longer look at the Euro-American conquest of the West as an unmitigated good, and we no longer look at it merely as the march of progress. There's a totally different, not totally, but a substantially different moral mindset, and a very different moral judgment is rendered now than was rendered then about what happened to the native population in North America. In any event, come 1948, the Zionist movement used the cover of war, the Revolutionary Times, used the cover of war to expel the indigenous population of Palestine. Basically, what they did in 1948 is what the Serbs did in 1999, using the cover of the NATO attack, in this case using the cover of the Arab attack, to carry out long-held plans for expulsion. And by the end of the first Arab-Israeli War of 1948, about 80% of the indigenous population was expelled from the area that became the State of Israel. For those of you who are new to the topic, I always try, to clarify issues for those who haven't read widely on the topic. Basically, 150,000 Palestinian Arabs are expelled from the area that becomes Israel, and those 750,000 Arabs become what we now call the refugee question, the Palestinian refugee question. Many went to live in refugee camps in what came to be called the West Bank and Gaza. Others went to live in Lebanon and Jordan and Syria and elsewhere. So when you hear references to the Palestinian refugee question, you're hearing references basically, but not entirely, but basically the Palestinians who were expelled in 1948 and now their children and grandchildren. Israel, the State of Israel that was created in 1948, encompassed approximately 80% of what's called British-mandated Palestine, and the areas that did not come under Israeli control are the areas that we now call the West Bank and Gaza. So when people refer to the State of Israel, they're referring to the borders that were created in 1948 at the end of the war, which comprised about 80% of Palestine. But there was another factor, not altogether trivial, that other factor is called the rest of the world. And the rest of the world offered a different resolution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. It was debated right after the June 1967 war, first in the General Assembly and then in the Security Council, and that came to be called UN Resolution 242. Without going into all the details and the semantics, the resolution is fairly straightforward. It says Israel, in accordance with the international law principle, that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war, the principle that's in the first preambular paragraph of 242, that Israel has to fully withdraw from the territories it conquered during the June 67 war. On the other side, it called on the Arab states to recognize Israel's right as a state in the region, namely it has to respect its borders, its right to security, and its right to live in peace. Basically, the formula is Israel, full withdrawal, the Arab states, full recognition. That was what was demanded on each side. The Palestinians weren't yet a factor. They become a factor in the early 1970s, and there's a slight modification, not a repudiation, but a modification of 242. And basically it says to Israel, full withdrawal, Arab states, full recognition. And then it says, when Israel withdraws from the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinian Arabs should have the right to exercise self-determination in their own state in the West Bank and Gaza. And that came to be called the two-state settlement. So basically you have on the one side Israel, backed by, crucially by the United States, committed to an apartheid-like settlement in the occupied territories, and the rest of the world committed to a two-state settlement. That, incidentally, is not hyperbole. The record is very clear on it. And what's interesting about the record in the two-state settlement is its remarkable stability, even in quite turbulent times from a historical point of view. So let me give you an illustration. If you look at 1989, the General Assembly, the vote in the two-state settlement, the vote is 151-3. 151 states on one side, the United States, Israel, and the island state of Dominica on the other side. People often ask, why Dominica? And I often, just as often say, because that's all that the dollar could buy back then. But then, if you go forward to 2002, now you have to keep in mind the map changed radically in those 13 years. The Soviet Union imploded, the Soviet bloc collapsed, and as many as 40 new states joined the United Nations. It was 154 in 1989, because there were no abstentions at 151-3 vote, and now I understand there are about 190 member states of the UN. So the map has changed dramatically geographically and politically. The Soviet system has disappeared. Nonetheless, the consensus on the two-state settlement has remained remarkably stable. So if you look at the UN voting for the year 2002, I checked the UN voting record. The two-state settlement, which called for Israel's right to secure and recognize borders, as well as a Palestinian's right to an independent state in the West Bank and Gaza, the standard two-state formulation, the vote was 160-4. The four dissenting votes were Israel, the United States, and then those two powerhouses, the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia. Now, if you go through all the votes, if you go through all the UN votes on the Israel-Palestine conflict, the maximum number of dissenting votes you get, because there are all sorts of votes on the applicability of the Geneva Convention to the occupied territories, renewing the funding of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. If you go through all the votes, the maximum number of dissents is six. And the six are the United States, Israel, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and then the two others are Nauru. Now, I have to confess that although I teach the topic, I had never heard of Nauru. And I was a little ashamed of that fact. And I mentioned in a couple of audiences, and there's always one person in every audience who's heard of Nauru. So let's see, who knows it here? There's going to be one.
They're on the phone card list of some
excuse me? Diving spots? Diving. Oh, diving. Well, okay, smarty pants. What's its main export? No. Okay, here we go. Now we have the expert. Who is it? Raise your hand. What's the main export?
Guano.
Guano. For those of you who don't know these technical expressions, bird droppings. Because the bird droppings eventually become phosphate. Yeah, that's true. They did run out of guano, bird drop. And it's one block long. Now, the other, well, in the South Pacific, yeah. I know all about it now because I'm being deluged with emails about Nauru, much more than I care to know. And the other main descent was Tuvalu. Now, that's a little trickier. Who knows Tuvalu? Usually the person who knows Nauru knows Tuvalu, but who knows Tuvalu? Ah, not impressive. It's Berkeley, not impressive. Well, in any case, the thing with Tuvalu is that it's disappearing. And that's a problem because as the tide rises, Tuvalu is disappearing. And there's a very interesting connection here because the tide is rising because of global warming. And as you know, the problem with global warming is that the United States won't sign the Kyoto Protocol. So basically, you have this sequence. The United States won't sign the Kyoto Protocol, and so there's global warming. And because of the global warming, the tide is rising. And because the tide is rising, Tuvalu is disappearing. And because Tuvalu is disappearing, one of Israel's main allies is disappearing. Which means, it's only a matter of time before Israel starts accusing the U.S. of anti-Semitism. Okay. It took me a long time to get that joke out. Okay. The two-state settlement supported since the mid-1970s by the Palestine Liberation Organization and subsequently by the Palestinian Authority and all the neighboring Arab states, a topic I'll get to in a few moments. The main problem for Israel has been precisely that beginning in the mid-1970s, Israel could no longer dismiss the Palestinians merely as terrorists because they had come on board supporting the two-state settlement. And now what do you do? And Israel was determined still to impose the apartheid-like settlement, still committed to preserving control of the West Bank and Gaza. And the main problem was they could no longer simply dismiss the Palestinian demand for self-determination and statehood as calling for their destruction. And Israel had a very interesting phrase. There's an Israeli mainstream political scientist named Avner Yaniv, and he calls it, the problem was, because the PLO had now supported the two-state settlement, he said the problem was Israel was confronted with the PLO's peace offensive. That was the problem. How to foil this peace offensive? And what they decided to do was in the early 1980s, the only way to foil the PLO peace offensive was to destroy the PLO as a political organization and then to claim there's nobody to negotiate with. And in June 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon with the announced aim of the destruction of the PLO. And by the end of the invasion by September 1982, they had basically achieved their goals. The PLO was sent into exile, and the Palestine question was pretty much marginalized internationally. At that point, the Palestinians, now we move on to 1987, the Palestinians realized that there was no possibility that the international community was going to rescue them from their fate. And in December 1987, the Palestinians engaged in a basically nonviolent civil revolt, which came to be called the Intifada. And the Intifada lasted for about 2 years and was in many ways, you know, was a remarkable display of, you know, of ordinary heroism, a very impressive display of that. But it was finally defeated by 1990. The Intifada was defeated through a combination of circumstances. Primarily, overwhelmingly, it was the brutal Israeli repression of the time. It's forgotten now quite how awful it was, though I suspect there are people in this room who are veterans of those years. But during the years of the Intifada, about 15,000 Palestinians were in jail each year. As a ratio to total population, There was nothing like it anywhere else in the world, and that included China, Cuba, or for that matter, Iraq. If you look at the amnesty, you don't have to believe me, and you shouldn't believe me. You should, you know, wherever you doubt it, you should just go and look at the record. But just go and open up the Amnesty International annual book for 1990, 1989, 1988, and you'll see that there were as many political prisoners in the occupied territories as there was in Iraq, but proportional to population, there was no comparison. There was also the, as Amnesty International Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem pointed out, and I'm quoting them, the systematic and methodical ill-treatment and torture of Palestinian detainees, which basically meant every single Palestinian, with a couple of minor exceptions, who was detained, suffered some sort of ill-treatment or torture during those years. It was a very brutal time, a very brutal repression. And by 1990, they had succeeded in crushing the Palestinians, though one has to also add as a factor, the Palestinian leadership was remarkably inept and corrupt and contributed to the defeat of the Palestinians. By 1990, the Intifada had been defeated, the Soviet Union had imploded, which means the main political support of the Palestinians had now disappeared from the map. After the destruction of Iraq, the Gulf states cut off their money to the Palestinians, and so now they lost their main economic support. So they have been defeated, on the, as it were, on the battlefield, although it was overwhelmingly a nonviolent civil revolt. They're defeated on the battlefield. Politically, their main political and economic supports have now been cut out from under their feet, and the Palestinians were in desperate straits. It looked as if the PLO was going to disappear because it was bankrupt. And it was exactly at that moment that the United States and Israel moved in because they saw another one of their great opportunities. And the opportunity was fairly straightforward. They had tried in the 1970s to create a kind of Bantustan leadership. For those of you who are not familiar with the term, those were the tribal homelands established by South Africa during the apartheid years. They had tried to establish a Bantustan leadership in the occupied territories. They were called the village leagues, but they were a complete failure. And now they had an idea, pretty smart idea, I think, that Mr. Arafat and his cronies were desperate. He knew that they were megalomaniacs and they clung to power, not to mention they were very corrupt. And they had an idea. We'll throw the PLO a lifeline and we'll tell them, if you do our bidding, if you do our bidding, we'll save you. And if not, it's bye-bye PLO. Basically, what they wanted, their aim was to put it in an analogy, which I think is pretty accurate. They needed a Nelson Mandela, somebody with nationalist credentials, who would play the role of a chief Buthelezi, a tribal chief of the Bantustan sort. And they thought they had that with Arafat. And that came to be called the Oslo Peace Process. The Oslo Peace Process was basically an effort to recruit the Palestinian leadership as Bantustan leaders as Israel preserved control of the West Bank and Gaza. Now, back then there were many people who understood it. I can quote to you Meron Benvenisti, the former vice mayor of Jerusalem, who's quite shrewd. He knows the West Bank and Gaza as well as probably anybody on earth. He knows the facts. I don't agree with his politics, but the facts are right. And he wrote at the time, referring to the Oslo Accord, he said, "The occupation continues, albeit by remote control, and with the consent of the Palestinian people through their representative, the PLO." And he went on to say, "It goes without saying that cooperation," which he puts in quotes, "based on the current power relationship is no more than permanent Israeli domination in disguise, and that Palestinian self-rule is merely a euphemism for Bantustanization." So already back then, those who wanted to know knew that this was the Israeli-U.S. game to try to establish a Bantustan in the West Bank and Gaza, but with the veneer of somebody with nationalist credentials. Now, you could say, okay, that's Benvenisti's opinion, and that may be your opinion, Mr. Finkelstein, but there were others who had other opinions about the Oslo peace process who were more hopeful and thought something good could come of it. And, you know, people can disagree about interpreting Oslo. But what you can't disagree with is about what happened, because now we're 10 years later, and we can just look at the facts and what did happen on the ground. And the facts are fairly straightforward. If you take, for example, the 2002 report published by Beth Selim called Land Grab, it's a very comprehensive report of what happened in the West Bank. And they say, okay, let's examine what happened during the Oslo years. And this is their conclusion. In the 10 years of Oslo, the number of settlers in the occupied territories roughly doubled. And the settlements now encompassed about 50% of the West Bank. Incidentally, they point out, dispelling another illusion about the Israel-Palestine conflict, that settler activity was always much more rapid under Labor governments than Likud governments, much more rapid under Mr. Rabin than his Likud predecessor, Mr. Shamir, much more rapid under Mr. Barak than under his predecessor, Mr. Netanyahu. Well, let's read their conclusion. Why should I summarize it? It's just two sentences, but two, I think, quite poignant and compelling sentences. How do they conclude? The report's about 200 pages. How do they conclude? Israel has created in the occupied territories a regime of separation based on discrimination, applying two different systems of law in the same area, and basing the rights of individuals on their nationality. So far, a technical description. What's their political conclusion? Worth trying to implant in your memory banks. This regime is the only one of its kind in the world and is reminiscent of distasteful regimes from the past, such as the apartheid regime in South Africa. And that, I think, is a kind of a, it's a remarkable, I suppose, testament to the accuracy of what Benny Morris said from the very beginning of the Zionist movement. You had two options, the expulsion or the apartheid. When expulsion was no longer available, they switched to apartheid. And after 35 years, they had created the facts on the ground and had created what they had set out to establish. To quote Mr. Beth Selim, the only regime of its kind in the world, strikingly reminiscent of distasteful regimes from the past, such as the apartheid regime in South Africa. The facts on the ground were there. You can call that the infrastructure was now in place. And now, to use those old Marxist terms, which I think only me and Aggie still remember, and now you had the problem of the superstructure, you know, legality and law. And the Zionist movement has always liked to have the deeds, to have it legitimized, because they're not foolish. There's a tendency on the left to be skeptical about things like international law and international morality and treaties and documents. No, they're important. And the Zionist movement wanted the document. Just as if you open any mainstream Israeli history, there's always two junctures in the history of the conflict that they point to. They always point to the Balfour Declaration and the 1947 Partition Resolution. Anyone who's ever argued the topic knows those are the two things that come up. Why? Because of the international legitimacy conferred on their aims. And in July 2000, they sought that third document. They wanted Mr. Arafat to sign on the dotted line and give over the deed to Palestine, or give over the deed to what remained of Palestine, namely the West Bank and Gaza. And basically that's what happened at Camp David in July 2000. Mr. Clinton, Mr. Barak, and Mr. Arafat huddled together with their multiple advisors at Camp David, and Mr. Clinton and Mr. Barak presented Mr. Arafat with an ultimatum. Either you accept the Bantustan, or you're finished. For reasons which are too complicated to go into now, Arafat rejected the Bantustan offer. And there are various interpretations of why. I have my own, but it's not so important. Arafat rejected the Bantustan offer. And at that point, Arafat quickly metamorphosed again into a terrorist. Up until 1993, he was a terrorist. When he signed on to Oslo, He became a statesman. There was all this talk, you remember, about they interviewed Suha, his wife, you know, to the extent that she was a wife. They interviewed Suha, and Suha would say, oh, Arafat does a wonderful tango, and she's going to lead the feminist movement in Gaza while shopping in Paris. And everybody loved Arafat. Was the toast of the town because he was being groomed as a tribal chief. And then come July 2000, he refused. If you look at the documentary record, he stood pretty hard and fast formally for the two-state settlement. He made some concessions, but I don't think significant concessions. He even said to Israel, okay, you can keep your large settlement blocks in the occupied territories. However, there has to be a land swap of equal value and equal size in Israel. So if you want to keep X percent, say 10% of the West Bank, then you have to give us 10% of Israel, a land of equal value and equal size. Basically, he stuck pretty hard and fast to the two-state settlement with minor modifications. That was rejected, and then Arafat, as I said, metamorphosed quickly into a terrorist again who was an obstacle to the peace process, which he was. He was an obstacle to the peace process, the aim of which was to establish a Bantustan in the occupied territories. Now, some of you in the audience may rightfully say, okay, that's your interpretation of what happened in Camp David, and certainly that's the interpretation of some people, but it's also true to say it's not the interpretation of many others. And you'll point to President Clinton. Why anyone would believe anything he says is a separate point, but they'd point to President Clinton, and they'd point to Dennis Ross and others. And I will say, yeah, it's fair. It's fair to say that there's dispute about what happened at Camp David. There is no written record. Nobody wanted to put their offers in paper, and there's no maps from Camp David. A lot of what we know relies on the testimony of the various participants. The best book on the topic right now is Charles Enderlin's Shattered Dreams. Everyone who was a participant promises to write his or her memoir. I think it's only his memoirs. So you can say the picture is confusing. And I'll admit, I'm not afraid to say, my interpretation is a partisan interpretation, though it comes from an American negotiator at Camp David, namely Robert Malley. But okay, let's even say it's controversial, it's partisan. But there are other facts which aren't controversial and partisan. So let's look at March 2002. In March 2002, the Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah put forth a peace plan to resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the peace plan not only endorsed the international consensus, it went beyond the consensus. The consensus, as I told you, called for full recognition of Israel. The Saudi plan went beyond that. It called for not only recognition, but the phrase normal relations was used in the plan, to have normal relations with Israel. Now, one of the sticking points in the Israel-Palestine conflict, one which I think at any rate is very difficult to resolve at a moral level, is the question of the refugees. And the Palestinians formally have stuck pretty hard and fast to the position of the right of return, namely basing themselves on UN Resolution 194 as well as multiple international covenants. The Palestinians have demanded the full right of all refugees to return home. I think it's a complicated question. I don't want to get into it right now. For our purposes, the important point is the Saudi plan, whether you like it or not, and I'm not saying I agree, I'm simply saying they did not uphold the right of return. They retreated from it, and they used the expression a just resolution of the refugee question. Not the right of return, but the more ambiguous expression, a just resolution of the refugee question. The Saudi plan won the endorsement of every single member of the Arab League. And it won the endorsement of the Palestinian Authority. And now an obvious question arises, which many Israeli commentators, or I should say some Israeli commentators, openly discussed. Namely, Mr. Barak claims he gave the Palestinians a wonderful offer at Camp David, and they turned it down. Now, says the Israeli commentator, but wait, what Barak claims he offered sounds an awful lot like the Saudi plan. So if what the Israelis offered, the Saudis and the whole of the Arab League and the Palestinian Authority, now they're offering, then why shouldn't the Israelis be euphoric? If that's what they were really offering, they should be very happy. In fact, what happened to the Saudi plan? I suspect there are probably no more than two or three people in the room who even remember it. It was another one of those dreadful, awful, horrific Palestinian peace offensives that have to be foiled. So it was quickly forgotten, tucked into George Orwell's memory hole, and it had only a small afterlife, but an interesting afterlife. You're all familiar with the roadmap. And the roadmap went through many, many versions before it was finally published. And in each of the versions of the roadmap, there was always a mention of the precedents to the roadmap. And they listed all the various proposals that had been made prior to the roadmap. So they would mention the Mitchell plan, the Tenet plan, all these, you know, happily forgotten plans. And they would always mention, or the Arab states insisted on mentioning, the Saudi plan. And if you follow the history of the roadmap, in each version, Israel was determined any mention of the Saudi plan has to be effaced. That has to be forgotten. Yes, it has to be forgotten. Another one of those dreadful peace offensives of the Palestinians. Well, as I said, the Palestinians rejected the Bantustan offer of Israel, and at that point, the Palestinians went into revolt in September, you know, just about 2 years now, in September, 3 years now. September 2000, the Palestinians entered into revolt in what came to be called the Al-Aqsa Intifada or the Second Intifada. And at this moment, the Israelis decided that the carrot had failed. The carrot was the Camp David, tempting the Palestinians with the perquisites of power and privilege in exchange for performing the role of a Bantustan leader. The carrot had failed, and now they brought out the big stick. And the big stick, as you all recall, was Operation Defensive Shield. And Operation Defensive Shield, it basically required two prerequisites to be launched. Number one, they needed the green light from the United States. The United States and Europe were unwilling to give the green light. The green light, however, came after September 11th, when U.S. and Israeli aims became more congruent. The U.S. was determined to exploit September 11th in order to crush any remnants of resistance in the Arab world. And the most potent symbol of resistance in the Arab world has been the Palestinian resistance. And now the United States acquiesced in the goal of the Israelis to crush the Palestinians. They got the green light from the U.S., and now all that they needed was the pretext. And Israel did as it always does, namely it started pounding away at the Palestinians until it evoked the terrorist reaction it needed in order to launch an attack. For those of you who followed the build-up to Operation Defensive Shield, it was almost an embarrassing replay of what happened on the eve of the attack on Lebanon in June 1982. In July 1981, the Palestinians had agreed to a U.S.-brokered ceasefire along the border between Lebanon and Israel. Israel was determined because of the Palestinian peace offensive to crush the PLO, and so they started to pound away at the Palestinians in southern Lebanon. The Palestinians held their fire, because they knew what was going to happen. Finally, in May 1982, Israel, in a particularly brutal attack, bombed a hospital, killing 200 people, civilians in southern Lebanon, including 60 occupants of a children's hospital. And at that point, the Palestinians reacted. They fired a few missiles in northern Israel and killed one Israeli. And that was the pretext for the Operation Peace in the Galilee. It's an interesting thing to remember. In the course of the attack on Lebanon in 1982, between June and September, about 3.5 months, the estimates are, and the best estimates, you know, come from Robert Fisk, who I understand will be speaking here tomorrow. The best estimates are 18,000 to 20,000 Palestinian and Lebanese were killed, overwhelmingly civilians. Now, if you go to the Israeli website, they post the number of Israelis who have been killed, or I should say Jews and Israelis who have been killed, since the very beginning of the Zionist movement, which they date from the 1860s. So from the 1860s to the present, namely a period of approximately 140 years, they give a figure for the total number of Jewish and Israeli casualties. They give a figure, if you check the website for this year, of 21,000. So it's 21,000 over a 140-year period. Now that figure includes all victims of terrorism, as well as all victims of the 48 War, 67 War, 73 War, the 69 to 70 Canal War, the 73 War, the 87 First Intifada, the 2000 Second Intifada, the whole period. 21,000 casualties over 140 years versus roughly 20,000 casualties over a 3.5 month period, with the difference being, not trivial, that on the Israeli side, it was overwhelmingly combatants. In Lebanon, it was overwhelmingly civilians. In any event, to bring us back to where we were, and I'm going to try to wrap up now, Israel started assassinating Palestinian leaders with the expectation it would evoke the terrorist attack. The terrorist attack eventually came, a couple of them came, and then Israel proceeded with Operation Defensive Shield. I won't go into the details now, only to mention that we're often told that during Operation Defensive Shield, the only thing the American media cares to remember is that it wasn't a massacre in Jenin. That's all we're told. It wasn't a massacre. But what's forgotten is not what it wasn't, but what it was. And if you turn, for example, to the human rights reports, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they all did excellent reports on what happened in Jenin. I'll just quote quickly, Human Rights Watch: Israeli forces committed serious violations of humanitarian law, some amounting prima facie to war crimes. Amnesty International: The IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, carried out actions which violate international human rights and humanitarian law. Some of these actions amount to war crimes. And they give very vivid examples of some of the killings. There are many interesting things to point out about it, but when I debate Alan Dershowitz on the topic, he writes in his book, quote, there was not one single deliberate killing of a Palestinian civilian in Jenin. So I said, really, Mr. Dershowitz? And I pull out the Human Rights Watch report, quote the section on the war crimes, and then I describe, for example, Human Rights Watch gives the following example. A paralyzed Palestinian is on a wheelchair. He's on the main highway outside Jenin. His wheelchair has a flag, a white flag on it. An Israeli tank runs him over. So I say, Mr. Dershowitz, is that a deliberate killing? I should point out the side thing that he had promised anyone who found a single factual error in his book would get $10,000. So, I mean, it was difficult to find a single factual error in his book because there were no facts in the book. But I know, I did my best. So what was Mr. Dershowitz's response? He said, it didn't happen. That's it. Well, then it's really tough to win $10,000. You know, it's telling a person from the Flat Earth Society, you know, you show a slide of the world round, well, it's not there. That's the level of argumentation. In any event, I'm going to now skip up to the present. Basically, what happened after Operation Defensive Shield, the U.S. went to war with Iraq, and the hope was exactly the same as what happened after the first attack on Iraq in 1990. Namely, after 1991, after the war ended on February 28th, after the war ended, the expectation was the Palestinians were so desperate, so psychologically as well as materially broken, that they can get them, to at least the leadership, to play the Bantustan role. And now the hope after the second destruction of Iraq was that the Palestinians would be so, to use the expression, shocked and awed by this terrifying display of U.S. power that now you can get them to play the role. They realized Arafat was hopeless. He just wouldn't do what was wanted of him. And so Arafat was discarded, and they came up with this other guy, Mr. Abu Mazen, who he also had nationalist credentials. He was a founder of the PLO. And as my very dear friend Muin Rabbani said, the difference between Arafat and Abu Mazen is Arafat is corrupt, incompetent, but elected. Abu Mazen is corrupt, incompetent, but he was unelected. And the polls showed that had there been an open, a free election in Palestine, the estimate was he would get between 3% and 5% of the vote, which means for the Americans, he was a perfect democratic leader of Palestine. In any case, that didn't pan out. It didn't work. Abu Mazen quickly, you know, became history. And now it's unclear how the Israelis will proceed. Some are hoping for a technical solution of the problem. Most of you are familiar because it's gotten fairly wide coverage in the American press. They're hoping for a technical solution, namely to enclose the Palestinians within a wall, to basically claim, and I'm not using the term, the very distinguished Israeli sociologist from the Hebrew University, Baruch Kimmerling, if you open up his new book, Politicide, on Sharon, he describes, I'm using his words, he describes Gaza as, quote, the world's largest concentration camp. And now they're trying to move the West Bank into the first rank of being the world's largest concentration camp, and they're trying to enclose it in a wall. Whether it will succeed, I can't predict. I mean, those things, nobody has the crystal ball that can tell you whether it will succeed. I have to say, I go over quite frequently there. And the last or the penultimate time I went over there, it was just when they were commencing the erection of the wall, or barrier, whatever you want to call it. And everybody was talking there about the wall. And it kind of had this kind of mystical resonance. And they all wanted me to go to Qalqilya, where, you know, there's the huge concrete wall surrounding it. And it was a kind of odd or an eerie experience for me because, as the person who introduced you mentioned, my parents were survivors of the concentration camps. And I don't usually like to use that because I think it's an unfair card in the debate. But for this particular point, I want to mention it because when I was growing up, there were only a handful of books written on the Nazi Holocaust, practically nothing before June 1967, practically nothing written on it. But there were a couple, and there was a couple of historical novels written on the topic. And one of them came out in 1961, 62 by this guy who I think the older people in the audience who remember, John Hersey. And I remember I was around 11, 12 years old. I was around 9 years old, and my mother said to me, you should read this book. And it was a book about the Warsaw Ghetto, a historical novel. And it was called, anyone remember? Yeah, it was called The Wall. And so it was a very kind of strange feeling for me that when I was there, everybody's talking about the wool, the wool. And to my thinking, for any Jew, and you know, you claim all this Holocaust consciousness, you know, for any Jew, the resonance should be very obvious. The wool, yeah, that was Hersey's famous historical novel about the wall that was built about around the Warsaw Ghetto to herd in the Palestinians. Whether it will succeed or not, I don't know. A lot of it, frankly, depends on us. Because I'm not Pollyannish. I've seen too much of life to be, you know, terrifically hopeful for human prospects, though I've not seen so much of life that I've become totally cynical about prospects for humanity. But I do remain fairly confident that this is a winnable struggle. The facts are not complicated. Truth is on our side. Justice is on our side. If we show a little courage, show a little integrity, show a little conscientiousness, I'm pretty confident we can win. Thank you. Agnes and Janice will be happy to learn that I remain, as I approach my 50th birthday, I remain a communist, and I believe in a world without any states. I don't see any need for states. I think we have to take Rodney King's credo and learn how to get along, not just in the United States, but all over the world. So I'm not keen on states as a personal preference, but you know, those are personal preferences. And then we have to be sort of take into account reality. And if we're moral actors, the most important reality we have to take into account is maximizing, to as much as it is in our power to minimize the suffering of the people there. The suffering is terrible, and the suffering is now generations long. My own view is, before you have a single state in Palestine, Israel will have to undergo such radical changes that if you now start calling for one state in Palestine for Jews and Arabs, you're basically writing off this generation and the next generation of Palestinians. I don't have it in me to do that. I know all the people, but I have enough friends there that I'm not ready to write off their lives and the lives of their children unless I am absolutely 100% certain that there is no possibility the two-state settlement and a full Israeli withdrawal can happen. I still think it's possible. I admit it's a small possibility. I still think it's possible there can be effected a full Israeli withdrawal. I admit it's a small possibility, but I still think it's there. If it proves impossible, then yes, we have to struggle for one state with equal rights for all. But we have to be morally serious about it. We can't throw out formulas which are pleasant to our ideologies, but which means inflicting generations of suffering for people over there. Because there's no possibility that within my lifetime, or I think even in the lifetime of students here, that Israel will undergo the kinds of changes that are required to make that one-state settlement possible. So before I move there, I want to be absolutely certain the two-state settlement is exhausted. Well, first of all, at the risk of sounding heretical, I don't think it's useful to cast this argument as being anti-Zionist or pro-Zionist, and I certainly don't think it's useful to cast the argument as being pro-Israeli or pro-Palestinian. I am not pro-Israeli, I am not pro-Palestinian. The issue is an issue of justice. Whether you are for a just settlement or an unjust settlement of the conflict. And I think as soon as we adopt the vocabulary that points to the heart of the issue, namely the injustices that are being inflicted in the Palestinians, we have a greater possibility of winning over allies than getting involved in these kinds of ideological, theoretical, and doctoral thesis topics like what is Zionism and whether or not you're a Zionist. I don't think it's useful. It's a particular advance, I think, for those of us who've been involved in this for many years, that say in the 1970s and 80s, it used to be called Palestine Solidarity Committees. I wasn't too keen on that because it sort of suggested you don't have solidarity with all of humanity. Nowadays, the committees around the campuses across the country are called Justice for Palestine. I think that's right. That's an advance. And it's a remarkable fact. I do a lot of lecturing on the topic. It's a remarkable fact that when you go to campuses across the country, who comprises these Justice for Palestine groups? Almost always, it consists of secular Jews, and in many cases, as in the case of our person over here, it consists of practicing Muslim women. And in many of the campuses, it is practicing Muslim women who are playing the leading role. And in a very moving way. I don't just say that. I experience it. I've had my troubles at, you know, trying to preserve a job. And the university where I'm currently at, there were efforts made to have me move on. And the students were very supportive. And, you know, I make no bones about my convictions. You know, obviously I am not a believer. I am an atheist and I am a communist and the whole thing. But my biggest supporters have always been the practicing, the observant Muslim women. They've been wonderful. It tells you something. It tells you something. It tells you something about the possibilities of people from very different backgrounds working together in a common goal of justice, and also tells you something about the silly stereotypes about Muslim women. I remember at one point it looked like I was going to be bounced out of my current school. The students put up some big protests, and I had to meet with the president. And I was going to the president's office accompanied by the chair of my department. And behind me, it was like sort of like out of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, students started to multiply to follow me. And they came to the president's office, and they sat in. And the president gave directions to the secretary to tell the students to clear out. And she did so. And a young woman named Rahan, Rashid, observant Muslim woman, she came over to me and she said, "Professor Finkelstein, do you want us to stay or do you want us to go?" I was really touched. She was so tough, but not tough in a brutal way, tough in a morally strong way. She has enormous dignity, very bright dignity. And she knows my politics, she knows my views about God or the lack thereof and so forth. And it didn't make a difference. My point is, if you project it the right way, justice for Palestine, don't get bogged down in Zionist this and that. Justice for Palestine, you can reach out to lots of people. There's a world out there to be won. The cause is just, it's not complicated. And I don't want to toot the horn of Jews. I've never been accused of being a Jewish chauvinist, and I'm not about to start now. But it's often forgotten, but definitely worthy of remembering. On every occasion, we all read about the international solidarity movement, the young people, and not always young people, who've gone over to the occupied territories to risk their lives, literally, to defend the ordinary rights of Palestinians, the rights to a home, the right to dig a well, and they're really courageous. It's not a false modesty on my part to say I don't have their courage. They're really very impressive. One is dead, one is brain dead, one's face was completely shattered. They're an impressive bunch. But it's also true to say, it's also true to say, one-third of them are Jewish. That's a very impressive show. You know, Jews, would they constitute 0.00000001% of humanity? But one-third of the ISM are Jewish. The struggle can win over a lot of people. If we phrase it right, do it right, we can win. There are no magic formulas for success. you know, there are new technologies. You know, there is the internet. I know about as much about technology as, you know, somebody from the 14th century. I've never even used an ATM machine. I dread the prospect of doing so. And I'm great at booting up my computer, but that's about where it begins and ends. But the technologies have been wonderful. You know, just to give an example, many years ago, 20 years ago now, I was involved in that struggle to expose the book from time immemorial. And it took me 2 years to make the breakthrough. It took 2 full years of my life. I was monomaniacally committed to exposing the book. Some of you, most of you probably know. How many of you know Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now? Okay. Amy is an old friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine. And when she had me on her program, she said afterwards, you know, Norm, you just did in 1 hour what it took you 2 years to do. It became a national issue in 1 hour. And that was through the, you know, the marvels of Amy's program and the internet. And suddenly, you know, it just, you know, people were commenting. Everybody had heard about the debate with Dershowitz. You know, so these are marvelous technologies and certainly democratizing technologies, and we have to be very grateful for them. It's regrettable that probably, with the exception of Amy Goodman, I couldn't appear on any other program in the United States. That is lamentable. And it's probably true that, with the exception of Alex Coburn, nobody else would have written about it in the United States. That is lamentable. But on the other hand, there is the internet and there are alternative means of communication. And I just think the obvious answer is it's new technologies with old methods. There's no real, if there were a magic formula for resolving this, it would have been done a long time ago. There are no magic formulas. The same way people have in other struggles succeeded, I think we can succeed here. And I honestly don't believe it's so difficult. The other side, as I said earlier, they're powerful and they're well healed. But sometimes, you know, they're remarkably stupid. I'm kind of amazed at that. You know, people ask me, why would Dershowitz do something so stupid like that? I mean, he's a chair. That's the highest honor. He's the Felix Frankfurter Chair at Harvard University. And God only knows he has money and resources. Why does he cobble together something so colossally stupid? Okay, it's true, they don't have the facts on their side. But really, did he have to use, as one of his references, www.sonypictures.com? Did he have to use, as another one of his references, I kid you not, it's breathtaking. Another of his references, when I finally tracked it down, was the chronology to a high school syllabus. He found on the internet some high school teacher who posted his syllabus with a chronology. And that's what Dershowitz cited. Now, it was for Black September, which is a central event in the conflict, you know, in September 1970. He could have made, you know, reference to any standard history. But the level of sheer incompetence. I mean, the embarrassment when I asked him, Mr. Dershowitz, SonyPictures.com/Black September? Aren't you ashamed? He said to me, well, it did come out as a book. I mean, when he was asked by the Boston Globe about it, go and look it up. You know what he responded? I wanted to use an accessible source. No, they're not so clever. They're not so smart. If we do our homework, we can do better than that, believe me. Look, American Jews are powerful. American Jews are well off financially. They're by far the most successful ethnic group in the United States today, far outstripping WASPs. That's a fact. And with that economic power comes political clout. And I think it's foolish to deny it. And they've, I think, in my opinion, I think American Jewish elites have carried on in extremely ruthless and reckless, and in my opinion, and also a very short-sighted way. I don't think it's wise for a minority, in the case of the United States, Jews are approximately 1.5% of the American population. I don't think it's wise, leaving aside the moral question, I don't think it's wise, from a prudent point of view, for American Jews to be carrying on the way they do. I think it's bad news. They're alienating everyone around them. And that's not smart. I've written on the topic what they did with the so-called Holocaust compensation throughout Europe was just sheer blackmail. It was simple as that. It was flat-out blackmail. And that doesn't just come from me. The world's leading authority in the Nazi Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg, who's a conservative Republican, he himself said, for the first time in the history of the Jews, they've made use of the blackmail weapon. In what they carried on with the Swiss banks, with the German companies, with Austria and everywhere else. That's not smart. You know, the answer of these Jewish hoodlums, they say, Jews don't cause anti-Semitism, anti-Semites cause anti-Semitism. I beg to differ. I think they're causing anti-Semitism. I think they're creating it everywhere they go, due to their ruthless and reckless tactics. They're also trivializing the Nazi Holocaust by saying what the Palestinians are doing is no different than what the Nazis did. Well, that makes the Nazis look awful good. Is that all they're doing? That's all the Nazis did? They were trying to resist Jewish oppression? That makes the Nazis look awful good. So, I think what they're doing is ruthless, reckless, and politically very stupid. And I think it's also a legitimate topic of intellectual, scholarly, and political inquiry, the kinds of power that American Jews exercise in American life, and, you know, the kinds of influence and impact they have on American policy. In and of itself, there's nothing anti-Semitic about that. That's a legitimate grounds of inquiry. As to the conclusion, do I believe American Jews now control U.S. policy, you know, in the Middle East? No, I don't. I don't think the factual record will bear that out. But is it a legitimate question? Sure it is. And no one should be afraid of raising it. But I happen not to agree with the conclusion of those who think that, you know, even the war in Iraq was an Israeli-inspired initiative. No, non-Jewish American elites had very good motives for wanting to control Iraq. There was a confluence of interests. Certainly the Israelis wanted it. But the idea that the American elites were resisting and the Israelis were pushing, no, I don't think the record supports that.
It's good you talk about Israel being a passive part of American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. I think there's elements of that, but I also think Israel has its own independent initiatives. It's not completely acting at the behest of the U.S., though it's also true to say that there's very little it can do without the support of the U.S. I don't want to say nothing, but very little. I think that's accurate. I'm writing something now. You know, I wrote a short thing for the Harvard Crimson. I mean, I really feel like I've descended when I'm now arguing in high school newspapers, but, you know, college newspapers, but that's my venue, that's what I have to do. And I wrote an article called The Glove Does Fit, you know, a reply to Alan Dershowitz. And I'll be writing an exhaustive expose of the book. Unfortunately, there won't be time to minimize the damage because the book is going to cause a lot of damage. And I probably won't be finished for about 6 months. So I'll be working on that. And then I have my book, The Rise and Fall of Palestine, is going to be reissued by the New Press. And I'm writing a very long introduction. It's basically the story of my life. And two of the leading characters are in the room today. Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye.